Some of the charges are dropped in a local notorious jaywalking case that went viral. Edward Waters College announces needed redevelopment in the Newtown area. And Mayor Lenny Curry says get ready for some massive infrastructure improvements. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the podcast on iTunes or our WJCT app. Listen there anytime. Stream us live right now, too, on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Just ahead, a look at the biggest stories of the week with our Friday Roundtable. Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, it's a festival for bird watchers. We'll hear about the large migration of purple martins in downtown Jacksonville and a look at the latest artist at Mocha's Project Atrium. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday and time for our weekly roundtable as we welcome Dan Scanlon, reporter for the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
David Cotton of the Financial News and Daily Record.
Good morning.
Good to see you. And Folio Weekly editor Claire Goforth, also here today.
Good morning, Melissa.
So good to have you all with us. Lots to discuss this Friday. Everything from big new infrastructure spending plan for the city to a windfall for Edward Waters College. But our top story, one of the two traffic tickets that was issued last month to a local man has been dropped. Now, this is in connection to a jaywalking charge that was actually recorded on video and went viral across the country. JSO is dropping one of two tickets issued to Devante Shipman. Now, he was ticketed for not carrying a driver's license by Officer J.S. Bolin as he was crossing Arlington Road. Court records now say the license citation was issued in error. But in response, a group of activists calling themselves the Jacksonville Community Action Committee are urging people to call Sheriff Mike Williams and demand Officer Bolin's firing. The group's Sarah Mahmood told WJCT there need to be consequences for what her group calls racial profiling and misuse of authority.
We need to make it clear that there is going to be accountabilities for these officers, and this is the way to do it.
Shipman was not driving a car at the time he was stopped. Florida law states a driver's license needs to be in possession when you're operating a motor vehicle. However, he was on foot at the time. Shipman says he's going to fight the remaining jaywalking charge in court and says that the incident is fanning the flames of longstanding accusations that JSO targets African Americans for harassment. We begin the hour with a closer look at this. What do you think about the outcome of this jaywalking incident? 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Or weigh in on Facebook. Dan Scanlon, let's begin with you. Shipman says he was the only person ticketed in this jaywalking incident, even though someone else was captured on video jaywalking, as Shipman argued with the officer. He calls this racial profiling and said this wouldn't have happened to someone jaywalking in Ponte Vedra Beach, for example. The quote from Shipman, they pick on poverty. This has really become another, yet another flashpoint incident when it comes to our local police and relationships with African Americans in Jacksonville. Your thoughts?
And we're having flashpoints like this across the country with police officers for minor infractions that turn into major arguments and in some cases turn into worse. In this case, jaywalking is such a minor infraction, and Mr. Shipman indicates that the officer where he was could not have seen the whole thing, so how does he know? And then how absurd to ticket someone who doesn't carry a license. I dare say a full third of Jacksonville's adult population does not have a license or has a Florida ID card only. So where did that come from and why? The confrontation, obviously, is born of something deeper than just, oops, you walked across against the light.
And, of course, the video of this has gone viral around the country. David Cotton, Claire Goforth. When you watch the video, you can kind of judge for yourself what you think about the incident. But people are interpreting it, of course, in different ways.
Yes, they certainly are. We posted it on our Facebook page, and the comments were quite revealing. Some people were very strongly behind the JSO officer in this incident, and other people said no. This is a case of racial profiling of a cop using low-level offenses to harass an African-American in a poor neighborhood. I think JSO's argument right now is that it's an isolated incident, it's an honest mistake, But really, the question is whether or not this is something that's an isolated incident or it's a systemic problem with JSO and with other police forces across the country.
And they are reviewing the incident. David Cotton.
Yeah, I think one thing that I take away from this situation and other situations across the nation is this was a missed opportunity by this JSO officer to maybe just, I don't know, simply educate this young man on the law and move on. Instead, it was turned into this big confrontation. It's now a video. It's gone viral. And now we're talking about it on First Coast Connect.
And, you know, the thing about it, I think, that struck people the most is that he was ticketed for not having a driver's license when he was walking.
It's
I think
just
that's
absurd.
Why this has taken off.
And, of course, the sheriff's office's usual response is, this is under investigation. We can't comment. Well, it's going to take a number of months for this to go through internal affairs and get investigated. And that whole procedure is also not open to public eyes. So we won't know what happens to this officer unless somewhere along the line there's some social media that says, ooh, look what happened.
Yeah, certainly. Mm-hmm. I think that we'll all be very interested to see what the outcome is of this. And a lot of people, they were critical of the young man for his reaction to the officer, and that they said that he had an attitude. A lot of the comments said that. But, you know, I would say that...
Yeah, he questioned, well, why are you stopping me?
Exactly.
Why are you citing me? Yeah.
He did. But I would say that if you had spent your entire life getting harassed by the police and seeing people around you get harassed by the police for something as simple as crossing the street during the daylight with arguably a flashing light telling you not to, and not carrying a driver's license, which is not an offense for someone who's walking, how would you react if you were stopped by the police again and again and again, and your friends were, and you were hearing these stories all in your life?
Well, especially in Jacksonville. I mean, this is not Chicago or New York where, yeah, jaywalking is a big issue. I mean, there's a lot of pedestrian traffic, and yeah, Arlington Road has traffic, but I think a lot of people would have had the same reaction of, why are you stopping me for something so minor?
But yet, as late as this morning, driving around, jaywalkers and a bicycle just blithely crossed my bow as I was driving, and I looked at them. They weren't looking at me. They didn't even notice that my car was there. So it is an issue here, not just Arlington Road, which I traverse, but anywhere in any city. And I understand a little education, maybe a warning ticket, or just a jaywalking ticket, which is nothing more than a misdemeanor and probably not much of a fine. It's the harassment. It is the lecture that was caught on social media. And we're seeing a lot of social media. And again, some of that social media ends up like the girlfriend of the guy who was shot as he's dying.
Which incident is that you're talking about?
I can't remember
about
where this was. It was, again, about a year ago.
It was not here in this area.
Not in the
city.
Yeah. But again, social media is so prevalent. The phone is so visible that these officers know they're on camera.
And that leads to the wider discussion that, Sheriff Mike Williams is having about putting body cameras on local police so that... police might see that as protection for themselves as well as the public. They can have a record of an incident that's controversial, though, because some local groups are saying they don't trust the police to use the video honorably. They want an independent review of body camera video and these types of incidents. This is a deeply contentious topic in Jacksonville and in every city.
It certainly is. It is interesting that the officer, knowing that he was being videoed, still behaved as he did. That tells you the level of entitlement that officers have to treat people as they do. And imagine just all the incidents that are not recorded, that are happening every day, that are like this and possibly worse in this community.
All right, let's go to your calls on this. Did you follow this jaywalking incident that went viral because of the video of it that was shared on social media? 549-2937. Keith is in Riverside. Hey, Keith, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. I called your show years ago when John Rutherford was on, and I... detailed to him an incident where an officer had given me a ticket for running a red light, which was completely bogus. And I had pictures. I didn't have a video camera then, but I had still pictures. I had a statement from witnesses. And the officers were very jocular about it until the camera came out and I started taking pictures. Then the whole attitude changed. When I went to court, the judge dismissed it on the weight of the pictures that I had and what I explained. But that was an isolated incident, just like all of these other isolated incidents that happen, which add up to a pattern of oppressive behavior. I've had multiple run-ins, not lately, I'm 60 years old now, but I've had multiple run-ins with the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, and they talk to me like I'm a dog. And in each instance, I haven't done anything wrong. They're just exerting their authority. I'm a retired naval officer. I know how to behave around the police. Hell, I've done military police duties. But it's very difficult when you don't know what approach the officer is going to make to you and you haven't done anything wrong. You should look at that video with your eyes closed and listen to the way that officer talks to that young man. That would piss me off also. Treat him like a citizen. If he was wearing a three-piece suit and was a white guy, I don't think he would talk to him like that.
All right. Thanks, Keith. And of course, that's where the issue comes, that this perception among many African-Americans that they're treated differently. Now, that said, as you pointed out, Dan, we have to wait and see how the review process goes. But I think the caller reflects the resentment that a lot of African-Americans in this community feel. On the other hand, police have a difficult job. They often have interactions with people in the community that can lead to escalation. What about this whole movement around the country for police to be better trained in de-escalation techniques? That they're doing that here in Jacksonville, too, so that these incidents don't get so out of hand so quickly.
You would think that part of your police academy training and probably refresher courses is how to deal with the public respectfully and avoid getting yourself cited or avoid increasing the tension in an incident. As a cop reporter at the Times Union, are constantly at crime scenes, and I watch interaction between patrolmen and reporters and patrolmen and the people who are just strolling around. Sometimes it's friendly, sometimes it's confrontational. Hey, I live down the street, I'm inside the police line, can I get to my baby? And I sometimes see that there's tension there, whereas just work it out better than you're doing right now.
Maybe they should watch Roadhouse. Patrick Swayze has some great advice in that movie. Be nice. Be polite. Mm-hmm.
Tom on the West Side. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, ma'am. I just wanted to say that it actually extends beyond race. I had a personal experience, and I'm white, and in this case, the officer was black, and just experienced very similar levels of abuse of authority. And the other thing I wanted to say about this is typical of how the city reacts. They did the exact same thing to me. They drop one charge, try and keep one charge going so that they can say that, we have the cover that you did do something wrong. And that gives them exoneration of a sort. Our JSO is in many ways feels entitled when it deals with the public, just like the gentleman was just saying. And it's something that needs to be addressed in training. Thank you.
Thank you. David?
I believe Claire just said that. But hey, either way, I know that there are communication issues with authority and people. I mean, look, I was in Neptune Beach for the 4th of July, and I dealt with several police officers that were friendly. I dealt with a few, though, that were pretty aggressive towards people. So, I'd hate to just lump all those police officers into one group like
that's
that.
That's very true.
Sure.
My first cousin is a Baltimore City police officer, and he is an excellent person. I have no doubt that he conducts himself with integrity and with respect in the field. And many JSO officers do exactly that. And they are doing a very hard job, and they are trying to keep us safe, and we all respect that. But that doesn't mean that they're infallible, and we can't criticize incidents that we notice.
And I need to put forward that a lot of interaction I have with police is wonderful. There are sergeants, lieutenants, captains, brass, and patrolmen, young as well as old, who are perfectly conversational with me as a reporter when I'm at a crime scene, and they know how to deal with just having a chat. And that's the majority of who I run into. It's only a handful that I run into as a 61-year-old white guy and a reporter that sometimes our granite walls or just don't know how to even say, good morning, how are you?
All right, let's go to Jay on Beach Boulevard. Jay, I hope you're not jaywalking across Beach Boulevard. Ah-ha-ha. I'm sorry.
No.
Good morning, Jay.
Hi, how are you?
Go ahead.
No, I'm not jaywalking. honestly, to me, this situation, it is racial. But it is like the guy was saying, it's beyond race. There's no excuse when you tell somebody that their job is hard and what they do has dangers that come with it. That's not an excuse anymore. if that's the case and that's the job that you have, that's the job you have. You took upon that responsibility with the job that you wanted. Now you have it. So the fact that any excuse of, well, we have a hard job and sometimes we get through all these trials and tribulations, that doesn't mean you pull a gun out. And these are things that are happening. As far as the jaywalking incident and the video that's viral, there's no need for anybody to have a doubt about it. We are in the southeast of the United States. These are things that go on all over the United States, but these are things that are always and always have been more prevalent in the southeast of the United States. And these things happen more often than not to black people. It does happen to white people just as much, but more often than not, it's black people. I'm from Georgia. I'm a transplant here in Florida. I've only been here roughly 2 years. And these are the same things that have been going on for years where I'm from in Georgia. And it is what it is. And the problem is that the same sentiment I just said is the sentiment everybody has. Well, it is what it is. Nobody is going to stop JSO from doing what they're doing, period, point blank. If they were going to stop, they would have been stopped by now. They have 101 excuses, and that's in less than 24 months since I've been here. I've heard them all on the radio that I've heard over my lifetime, and I'm 40 years old. So this isn't going to end. JSO doesn't need to be trained more. JSO needs to have wrinkles put on them, plain and simple.
All right, Jay, thanks.
Yeah, I mean,
and yeah, I appreciate the call. And by the way, there's a lot of people waiting on hold. A lot of anger about this. But what about his comment that nothing can force departments to improve their interactions with the public? I would take issue with that only in the sense that plenty of police departments around the country are making serious efforts to address this type of issue. It's not impossible.
It's not. And, you know, you really can't reverse centuries of culture in a few decades, but we have to try and we have to do better. And I believe that the caller, I mean, it's heartbreaking to hear the emotion in his voice and that sense of this is never going to change. And you encounter that again and again when you speak with black people in Jacksonville. And it's very sad. And if JSO wants to hide behind the thin blue line or the thick blue line, as it were, and pretend like there isn't an issue, then we're going to continue to see these feelings of hopelessness from people that live in our city.
Chris at the beaches. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Great subject. Great show. I have lived in affluent areas and I have lived in poor areas. And I don't know if the police are aware of this, but when I lived in poor areas, people got ticketed for jaywalking all the time. I got a ticket for jaywalking when I lived in a poor area. And I've never seen it, and I've never received a jaywalking ticket in a wealthy or affluent area. It really annoys and irritates people in poor areas, which have lots of social problems and need all the police help they can get, to see police resources wasted on jaywalkers.
All right, thanks, Chris. Okay, and by the way, this kid that got stopped, he didn't say that they're picking on black people. He said they're picking on poverty. Agree or disagree there?
Well, I mean, he makes a good point there as far as, there seems to be, better things for this police officer maybe to do with this time than to give this big lecture to a young man about jaywalking. I haven't lived that life, so I'm not sure what that disproportionate is, how disproportionate that is, but I think we do know there is some.
And let's just get a couple more calls on this and then we'll move on. Blair in Mandarin. Hi, Blair.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for the show, Melissa.
Sure.
Well, as a 50-year-old black man here in Jacksonville, we're originally from New York State, but I've been here via Georgia, but I've been in Jacksonville about 10 years now. And from what I've seen here and as far as the conduct of the police here have carte blanche. We're talking about a jaywalking incident. We have multiple killings of young black men in this city by JSO last year, the year before that. There's always some type of internal review, but the internal review is being internally done by people, by the police are policing the police, in other words. And the fact of the matter is that I've had confrontations or incidents at my own place of business. I have a burglar alarm go off. At the time, I was living not too far away from my business. So when the alarm goes off, I go up there, I get that my GSO. I'm immediately a suspect.
Right.
And I'm trying to explain, I have a business card, I have the keys to the building. I'm in the back of a police car. My name is stenciled on the side of the building. Who does that? Recently, my brother-in-law had an interaction, and this isn't just exclusive to JSO, in Clay County, in Oakleaf, where his son and two other little gentlemen that live in the neighborhood over in Oakleaf, they're out with their BB guns. You know, I don't think there's anything illegal about that. But when he arrives on the scene, they're stopped by a Clay County deputy, and his son is in the back of the police car, and the other two little boys that were there are sitting on the curb. So when his neighbor, who is the father of the other two little boys who happen to be white, comes there, he asks, "Well, why is my neighbor's son in the back of the police car?" They said that they needed to make sure that his weapon was not real. Mm-hmm. I found that to be utterly ridiculous. Utterly ridiculous. And this is the mentality that when I have to counsel my sons on how to conduct themselves so that they don't get killed by one of these vigilante cops that have whatever issues they have within them. Because those same issues that they have at home, when they put that uniform on, they have those exact same issues then. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, Blair, thanks. So many people sharing stories. In a moment, we're going to go to a call from a retired police officer. But genuine anger and frustration about this. And, you know, for many years, Dan, in this city, African-American activists have called for an independent review board for these types of controversial incidents, particularly when someone gets killed. JSO's position is that other cities have tried this and it hasn't worked well.
Well, the one point that he brought up, Jacksonville Sheriff's Office is the only police sheriff's office that, when there's a police-involved shooting, conducts its own independent review, its own review with the state attorney's office. Other area counties hand it over to FDLE, Florida Department of Law Enforcement, for investigation. Now, in all of those cases, none of these are public, and we don't find out until they're done. But in JSO's case, it takes a very long time, and we're still awaiting the results of some very controversial police-involved shootings from over a year ago.
And should JSO hand investigative authority over to FDLE?
I mean, I think the argument is there.
Has been made
multiple times, and people have criticized this heavily. Do we trust the police to review the police? I don't know.
Tom in Mayport. Oh, excuse me. Wrong. Hang on a second. Tom in Mayport. Hi, Tom. Good morning. Hi, Tom. Are you there? Okay, we had a retired police officer calling in named Tom. He wanted to give some thoughts. Tom, are you there? Okay. Well, unfortunately, he's not there anymore. That's too bad. I would have liked to have heard what he had to say,
yeah,
too. And we do need to move on and talk about some other news and notes from the week. Did you watch this one, guys? Edward Waters College announced this week an $8.4 million project to renovate dorm rooms on campus and build a new athletic field in the Newtown area. This is a major project for the university and redeveloping the Newtown part of the city. It's also part of what Mayor Lenny Curry is calling the safe neighborhoods part of the city budget. As we talk about public safety and police, what are your thoughts about this big infusion for the historically African-American Edward Waters College?
Well, I was there in the front row when this was announced, and there was major city council support. There was major college support. And the bottom line is they're thinking investment in the future. The head of Edward Waters is a former sheriff and basically stated, you can pay me now or pay me later. If we keep these kids in school, majority of whom are on some form of scholarship or public assistance, then they educate themselves, they graduate, they become taxpaying citizens. If you don't, we have to pay for them much more down the line, and he even said some of them are in prison. Also, EWC has done a good job of keeping that campus safe and a sanctuary as they work hard to do stuff in an area, 32209, in a zip code that has had the most murders last year of any. So
that's right.
We do have a question as to how a private institution can get $8.4 million in city funds. But that said, these are renovations that will include publicly accessible athletic facilities. So you have security guards that are there when you decide to take a walk around an athletic track and help your diabetes and your heart condition, which are also major issues in that community.
Sure. And it's 549-2937 to join us. David Cotton, the EWC campus has a Sheriff's Office Zone 5 substation on Kings Road. It also has on that site something called ShotSpotter, high-tech microphones designed to detect shootings and alert police.
Well, that's nice. Hopefully it is the settings are tweaked around 4th of July for about a week at least based on my neighborhood. I hate to be the contrarian here, but we're giving $8.4 million to a private university to fix a football field, which will be publicly available, and to improve some dormitories. I'm not sure that's going to keep kids in school. I think that scholarships go a long way to keeping kids in school. I think that if we really want to help the Black community in Jacksonville, maybe there are some programs at Edward Waters, and I commend them. You know, I mean, nothing against the university, but at the same time, you have to ask yourself, is this the best way to spend money when we don't have a homeless day resource center? We have serious issues with some of the Section 8 housing and many other problems in the community. I mean, why not a vegetable stand? Why not many other things that we could have done? This is a lot of money. It could have gone a long way for a lot of other programs.
Well, Nat Glover did state that some of this money, $4 million, would be going to renovating dorms that have mold issues and air conditioning issues, and even stated that one student has had to leave or is threatening to leave because the living standards make it impossible for that student to stay. So there is some logic that actually helping the dormitory will keep a student comfortable and allow them to study, et cetera.
And going beyond the debate over how this decision on spending at EWC was made, let's talk for a minute about the political skills of Nat Glover in landing this money in an era of tight budgets. Nat Glover graduated from Edward Waters in 1966. He was Jacksonville sheriff, of course, the first Black sheriff in Florida since Reconstruction, and then became president of the school in 2011. Nat Glover, a man that knows how to navigate the corridors of power in this city. Mm-hmm. David Cotton.
Yeah, I mean, it's not surprising at all. And also, when you look at the committees that are going to be coming up here, you've got leadership from those areas of town that are going to be on key committees. Finance committee, who are going to take a long, hard look at the budget, which we're not going to know what is in this full safe neighborhoods portion of the budget until July 17th. But, you know, if this is any indication, I mean, I don't know about you, Claire, but could we expect some more projects like this for those areas of town?
I would expect so, given the amount of power that voting bloc now has on finance committee. And it's, I mean, long coming. There have long been criticisms that the city budget has left Northwest Jacksonville out in the cold. And rightfully so. It's easy enough to drive around that area and see there are no sidewalks and the roads are crumbling. Infrastructure is a serious issue. Those are all projects that have been, you know, just like languishing on the city budget.
And I did ask the mayor how much of this $8.4 million is, or how of this Safe Neighborhoods budget proposal, he said a substantial part of that Safe Neighborhoods budget that he's presenting in a week and a half is EWC's. Don't forget, too, Nat Glover is an ex-sheriff. The first place in the city of Jacksonville that has the ShotSpotter system that allows you to target where gunshots are coming from is at EWC. The city of Jacksonville is planning to put those in through the sheriff's office, but Nat Glover got the first one.
Yeah, as I was saying, like Nat Glover knows how to get what he needs for that school.
And that ShotSpotter actually
helped
him.
Kudos to him, and it certainly will. Now, if you're just tuning in, we're discussing the biggest stories of the week with our Friday roundtable, 549-2937. And everyone just mentioned Mayor Curry's proposed budget. He will present it to City Council on July 17th. And you can expect a large proportion of dollars to be dedicated to infrastructure spending. There are lots of projects in need of funding across the city, and Curry says now that the city's pension problems have been resolved, he wants to make some long overdue infrastructure repairs, everything from preparing the former county courthouse and city hall annex on Bay Street for development, maybe putting in a new convention center there, toward money going toward improving the Emerald Necklace. That's the waterway loop around the downtown urban core that includes Hogan and McCoy's Creeks. And more. How do you think the city should contribute funds toward infrastructure? 549-2937. Lots of needs there.
Yeah, certainly. And all these are excellent expenditures of the city budget. I do think that, you know, if we have longer memories than just this news cycle, we may want to suggest that our grandchildren will be paying for this courtesy of the pension tax that is freeing up a lot of this money for these projects that have long been waiting. So, good and bad to it. David.
Yeah, I mean, you would hope that, you know, the mayor would want to focus on infrastructure. Any good mayor of any major city would want to invest a lot of money into infrastructure, especially in a city the size of Jacksonville, where, as we just talked, there are parts of town that really need this. But there are other major projects as well. You've got the shipyards development, which is going to cost the city tax, you know, it's going to cost the city sure. money and infrastructure, the district, if that ever gets off the ground, and other projects. So I think it's going to be interesting to see where his priorities are in that.
Well, it's got to be potholes. I mean, every mayor that I can think of in the past 30 years I've worked here has discussed the issues with potholes. Our roads are horrible. FDOT has put more money into the highway system and state road system in Northeast Florida, as I did in a story back in December, than anywhere else in the state of Florida. And yet you get onto the city roads and bump, bump, crash, bang. So that is a major infrastructure need that affects all of us in our pocketbooks. And then obviously we're having other issues with failing infrastructure. The city is old. And actually very old in places.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Patrick in St. Augustine. Hi, Patrick. Good morning.
Good morning. I was just calling as a student of urban planning. I studied that. Just hearing the past two issues that were discussed regarding race and the way the law enforcement handles these issues, the way certain sections of Jacksonville have been neglected over the years, I think it's a bigger indicator of how Jacksonville's lagged behind on the national stage as a major city, major coastal city that hasn't been able to draw the crowds and the infrastructure and attention that's really needed to revitalize that downtown and get those infrastructure dollars working in a positive manner. Whereas you see towns like New Orleans, Houston, you know, these major cities that are really flourishing, it seems like Jacksonville's still just sputtering. So I'd like to hear what y'all's thoughts are on that.
Okay, thanks, Patrick.
Claire. I'm sure Tony Slaman has some thoughts about how we could spend some of this money. He's been, you know, he and the mayor have been tangling about the Jacksonville Landing. He would like to get some city money to redevelop that property. This mayor's office right now isn't really budging on that, and time will tell how that shakes out. But my prediction is that it's going to drag out for a while, because my assessment of Tony Slaman is that he does not give up easily.
Well, you know, if we get to the pun here, the grassroots of this whole thing is evident when we drive by and look at grass in city medians that is now cut on such a long schedule that it gets knee high before it gets cut. That's an infrastructure need that looks to the appearance of what a visitor sees when they come in. If they see knee-high grass in a median, if they see dead trees in a median, that's not a good image.
And we've got such a big spread-out landmass, David Cotton, that contributes to some of these competing needs.
Well, yeah, and of course, if you're somebody who lives in a part of town that has a lot of potholes and needs, you know, new sidewalks, when you see something like this road diet project on the South Bank that's going to be great and pedestrian friendly for all of the people who live in condos on the South Bank, it's hard to get excited about that. But you know, you just said it. This is a huge city that has, you know, a lot of need, and I think the mayor's going to probably put a lot of money in there for infrastructure.
Yeah, septic tank phase out and flooding are other serious issues that the city has to tackle.
Okay, now we're going to talk about some not so serious issues. Finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week around the state. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And thanks to everyone this week who sent us ideas for this segment. We're getting lots of them lately. Only in Florida does an anonymous graffiti artist paint public pictures of buttocks. Yes, you could call it a derriere dilemma, a keister caper, or even a rump riddle. People in St. Petersburg are very concerned about dozens of graffiti drawings popping up across the city that celebrate, yes, the human rear end. Now, St. Pete is a city known for its beautiful public art and stunning murals. So many St. Petersburgites are upset by this new graffiti that pushes a tush trend. I haven't seen these pictures. Have you guys?
You know, my cousin lives down there. I should ask him.
Ask him about this. St. Pete police described the butt graffiti as an eyesore, and they are trying to learn the identity of the artist and arrest them.
I just can't think of a wisecrack for that.
Oh. That's unprecedented, Dan Scanlon.
For once, Jacksonville is not the butt of the joke.
But I'm bum. But I'm bum.
Only in Florida does a Florida man. You gotta love Florida man.
Florida man.
Best Twitter account.
Only in Florida does a Florida man remove an iguana from his toilet with his almost bare hands. Now, most of us would scream or call 911 if we walked into the bathroom and saw an iguana hanging out in the toilet bowl. But South Florida Univision reporter David Adams just took matters into his own hands. He used old ski gloves, a gas mask, and a bulletproof vest to remove the beast from his bathroom, using nothing but an old beach towel to pick the creature up, and then he released the iguana into the wild. The critter made its way into the toilet after it crawled through the plumbing vent on the roof of Adams' Key Biscayne home. Now, although they are not amphibians, invasive iguanas can hold their breath for several minutes underwater and swim through pipes right up into your toilet.
So there's a journalist who has a tale to tell.
Yes.
I was going to say maybe he was afraid he would get arrested for assault with a deadly lizard.
I mean, he's walking in there with a gas mask. I'm probably just going to Snapchat it. You know,
like bulletproof vest for.
You know, you're equipped for all sorts of things when you cover stories for TV news. And, you know, now he's got the mother of all stories to tell.
Certainly.
Thanks to our panel, Claire Goforth, Dan Scanlon, and David Cotton. Thanks for being here.
Have a great weekend.
You
Thanks,
too.
Melissa.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back.
Summertime, you need something for the kids to do.
Hello.
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 This is Morgan Miller.
And Lizzie McGrath.
Reporting live on the Soccer Academy.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Sure, it's fun, but summer camp is serious business, too. That's next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Michael Wood explores 4,000 years of China.
They're anxious to place themselves in the world as a force for good.
Discover how technology can make it easier to travel.
You just hold the button, you speak into it, and it translates on the screen in real time.
And take your kids to Europe.
People are so kind to kids everywhere,
oh, they
so that's
are.
Really fun.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday mornings at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Christian McBride. On the next Jazz Night in America, it's David Murray. We'll hear music he presented at the 2015 Winter Jazz Festival in New York, including the late, great pianist Jerry Allen. We remember her and hear some incredible improvised music. That's next on Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, bird watchers around the area are enjoying a real treat this month. About 10,000 purple martins are roosting in the trees between the Jacksonville Landing and the Times Union Center. This is extraordinary, this pre-migration roosting of these birds, and it will go on all month. Brett Moyer is Education Director with the Duval Audubon Society and joins us now. Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
This is a rare sighting, isn't it, of these types of birds, purple martins, a big deal for bird watchers.
It's unusual that you see so many in one place. There are some around the nation like this, but we hadn't realized the significance in Jacksonville until quite recently.
Okay, so these birds are a type of swallow, and they're gathering mainly at night in this little area downtown. About 8 or 9 o'clock at night is the best time, I'm told, to go see them. What can you tell us about these birds, and why are they roosting here in this little spot of downtown Jacksonville?
Well, they have recently finished nesting. They nest in human-provided nest boxes around town and in the broader region. And they, after they're done nesting, they come to feed and gain strength before migration. And they are a social species, nesting colonially. And they gather strength before they travel 3,000 miles to Brazil for the
winter.
That's
where they're headed, Brazil.
Yes.
Wow. And where did they come from on their way south?
They came, well, they nest in Jacksonville.
They nest here all the time. Okay.
And further north, too.
It's unusual to see so many of them in one place.
You'd have to go 200 miles to find a similar roost.
And we don't know what's caused this, just this huge cluster of them.
Well, they gather in both natural areas and urban areas in various places across the U.S. Some think it's a place to avoid predators, being in large numbers where predators are easily seen, but close to food access.
Now, you found references online, a report from a birder back in the 1940s of 10,000 purple martins massing in Heming Park. So this isn't the first time.
For
this
70 years,
here?
They've been here. And unfortunately, in 1950, apparently, they cut down all the trees in that region, and that forced the roost to move elsewhere.
Oh, that's too bad. So for bird watchers, can you explain a little bit? Because people are really passionate about this in the bird watching community. But for those that aren't, what's the fascination?
Well, for 2 hours before sunset, they gather, accumulate in the sky, and then about 8:30 or so, they swoop down in large numbers, zipping above the head and chattering, and it's just a remarkable group of feathers.
It's extraordinary to watch it happening. When's the if people are interested in seeing this, when's the best time for them to go to this little spot and check it out?
I would recommend tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
The DeVal Audubon Society is hosting a viewing at about 8 to 9, and don't get there after 8:30. That's when the action really starts, but we'll have various people that can help explain what's going on and point out the highlights.
Oh, how exciting. So this is tomorrow night, 8 o'clock. Come downtown to Hogan Street between the Jacksonville Landing and the Times Union Center for the Performing Arts, right?
Yes.
And better make tracks, though, because by the end of the month, Brett says, the birds will make their way down to Brazil. And they're going to nest there along the Amazon, you say?
They won't nest. They'll just hang out there eating tropical insects, and then they nest up in the U.S. So they'll travel back maybe February of next year. They'll be back in Jacksonville and starting a new round of nesting.
Wow. This is such a cool topic, and it's great to have an expert such as yourself. Come on out tomorrow night to the end of Hogan Street, right near where it goes to the river.
That green pavilion.
That green pavilion between the Landing and the Times Union Center, and see this extraordinary sight of 10,000 roosting purple martins.
Even 20,000 there. They are accumulating as martins come from further afield.
Wow. Very cool. And Brett Moyer, Education Director with DeVal Audubon, providing his insights. You can meet him tomorrow night at that event. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
As the mercury rises this summer, what could be worse than turning on the oven? I'm Ira Flatow, this week on Science Friday, How to Cook Without Heat, the latest in our food failure series. Plus, over 80% of the top science jobs in the Trump administration are unfilled. Are the vacancies keeping science policy from moving ahead? It's all on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, it's Chris Thiele inviting you to join us this weekend for a mile-high version of A Prairie Home Companion from Denver, Colorado.
What a lineup this week. Trey Anastasio, The Staves, The Comedy of Tignataro, plus the Royal Academy of Radio Actors, Tim Russell, Serena Brooke, and Fred Newman. Also, Miss Aoife O'Donovan will sing some lovely songs for you, along with Rich Dworsky and our First Call Radio Players. Tune in this weekend for all this and more.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
The very best of modern folk and acoustic alternative music tonight on String Theory. Listen to String Theory this evening at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Tune in, find out.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, he's building a rainbow right in front of your eyes. The new Project Atrium artist at Jacksonville's Museum of Contemporary Art is putting together a fascinating new installation. Here with more, we welcome artist Gabriel Daw. Good morning.
Good morning.
And MoCA curator Jamie DuSimone. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Okay. Gabriel, you're building a three-dimensional rainbow, and this is done with polyester thread, I understand. Is that right?
Yeah. So it's not exactly a rainbow. It's a site-specific installation that looks like frozen rays of light in space. And I'm not trying to imitate nature, so it's not really a rainbow. But I do use the color of the full spectrum, so it does have the colors of the rainbow.
And so what inspired this, and why are you using threads?
Well, I started using thread because as a kid growing up in Mexico City, where I'm originally from, I was forbidden to embroider.
Why?
Because I was a boy. And so it was something that was reserved for girls. And later on, I remembered that frustration. And as a grown man, I decided, well, I can teach myself to embroider now.
And now you're embroidering a huge project.
And now I embroider in space.
Oh, man. Okay, Jamie DuSimone, you're the curator on this. What's this going to be like for people that come to MoCA? They'll be able to watch Gabriel building this thing too, right?
That's correct. Gabriel and his assistant have been working tirelessly for the last week and a half, and they have another 3 or 4 days to go to complete the project. So we invite everyone to stop by during the installation and really see its ongoing process day to day.
That's what's so nice about your Project Atrium series. People can see the finished product, but they can watch it being created at the same time.
Exactly. And we really think that opportunity builds an investment with the community, and they have access to the artist and to see it come together.
Now, my grandmother did a lot of embroidery, and she taught me how to do all of that, too, with a little needle and thread. You're using a giant needle and thread. You're using an extension pole that sort of functions as a needle to create this. Is that right?
Right. Right. So the first piece I ever did was a big experiment, and I just went up and down a ladder like 300 times a day. It was exhausting. So I knew that like very fast I had to come up with something that would help me in the process of putting them up. And I came up with this tool that, like you said, is like a giant needle.
What is this called, this piece that you're making?
It's called Plexus Number 38. And I named this series Plexus because the word means a network of vessels, blood vessels or nerve endings in the body. And what I'm creating is technically a network of thread. So, and then I serialize it. So I'm on number 38. And I've actually done more than 38 because I have two sequences, but I've done like 60 of them overall.
Wow. And what do you hope people who take in this art, what's the takeaway? What are you trying to evoke with this?
Well, I really love how people, when they encounter my pieces, they just go into this space of wonder. And it really... it's amazing seeing how people kind of like drop their jaws when they encounter the pieces. And that's basically one of the goals here, to just sort of mesmerize people.
And that's the goal for MoCA as a whole, of course, correct?
Exactly. We just want people to really be aesthetically pleased and think about the capabilities of this space by inviting new artists in 3 times a year.
And how can people access the installation as it's being created? Are you still working on it right now?
Yes.
Okay, so people can come any day and see this.
They can. Not on the weekends. We do let him have some time off. But there is a lot of coverage on Mocha Jacksonville's Instagram feed, where Gabriel has agreed to take over, as well as our Facebook page.
And so just stop in by the museum any weekday and see artist Gabriel Daw at work creating this large-scale piece in the atrium there on the ground floor of Mocha Jacksonville. Gabriel, a pleasure. Curator Jamie DeSimone as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having
us.
Thank
you.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. We always want your feedback. Send emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And never miss a show. Download the WJCT app and listen to our podcast there or on iTunes. Up next on 1A, the weekly news roundup. And if you missed today's show, hear our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.